My name is Norman Andersen. I'm educated as a psychologist here in Bergen, at University of Bergen. That means a clinical psychologist. I'm working now as a professor here at University of Bergen in social psychology. I have had two main topics as my research interest. It's been a kind of mainstream type of interest, related to health behaviors using standardized methods, survey methods, statistical procedures, so on. And the other strand is gay and lesbian issues. So that's what we're talking specifically on now, I guess.
Yes.
So my research themes have been connected to the experiences of ordinary people regarding gay and lesbian issues. That means not the experiences of gays and lesbians themselves, but the majority, so to speak. So I have been interested in the tension or the landscape regarding how do gays and lesbians navigate or live their lives within an environment which is more or less positive or negative towards homosexuality. It's attitude research, and the research question is, what are typical attitudes in Norway regarding gays and lesbians?
Considering that Norway is such a progressive legislative environment, in other words, it's a place in which gay and lesbians have rights that are not even a dream in other countries, what are the attitudes in the social environment in regards to LGBTQ communities?
It's on one level, it's very positive. Most people in Norway are positive towards gays and lesbians as persons and towards their legal rights regarding family relationships, the opportunity to make partnerships like marriage, and also regarding the right to adopt children. So, it's most Norwegians are positive towards that. At least they want to be positive, and they know that if I should be an updated person, I'm supposed to be positive to this, and I want to be positive to this. So, if we ask general overall questions, people will really support gays and lesbians. But we might also ask people many detailed questions, and then it turns out that they have their thoughts about this. And my impression, as I know the Norwegian society now, is that many might be negative in a face-to-face manner, at least for a few seconds, or at least in some situations, while on a very general level they will say, I want to support them, and I support them. So, for example, young gays and lesbians in Norway, they hesitate to tell their parents, they hesitate to tell their friends, as in many other westernized countries. So, obviously there are some hinders or some barriers towards full openness.
How do these negative attitudes manifest themselves, and what do you think are the grounds for these attitudes? Is it a general sense of heteronormativity in society, or?
You know, within queer theory, if you talk about gender or sexual categories, the more clear you make these distinctions and the more you thematize them, the more it's easy for people to have certain opinions about some of the categories. So I mean, it's a kind of a vicious cycle, not vicious cycle, but at least it's a kind of a logic that the more you insist that we have homosexuals, we have bisexuals and heterosexuals, the more you will also let people have opinions regarding these groups. So actually I think to really dissolve negative attitudes, we need to dissolve our concepts and notions of sexual distinctions, including gender, which is very radical. So in a way, I think that in line with general queer theory, as long as we have these very strong categories, we will also have negative attitudes.
Is there some work being done in society, say at a governmental level or any of its institutions, to promote the dissolution of these kind of categorical distinctions? For example, at the level of education?
Within the Nordic countries, there are some researchers doing classroom research, and they emphasize, for example, various ways of doing gender within the classroom, which is not connected to biological sex necessarily. And those researchers are heard at the department level. So, in a way, some places within the guidelines regulating national curriculums, things like that, there are phrases which opens up for dissolving categories in a way. But at the same time, I mean, all cultural expressions, all cultural activity is connected to gender dichotomies. So I mean, although there are some efforts, also official efforts maybe even, to dissolve categories, this counts very little after all.
Mm-hmm. What is the historical timeline, if you will, in relationship to the gay and lesbian movement, say from 1950 on, and how has its evolution been in regards to this particular issue of attitudes and social behaviors?
You know, as a psychologist, I'm not able to point at the huge societal changes which makes the ground for those kind of changes. I mean, it's economic reasons, because Norway has had is a rich country, and that means it's a gender equality regarding economic status. There are differences, but I mean, compared to many other countries, it's quite well. So there are some huge societal forces making the changes possible regarding attitudes. And maybe also it's kind of cultural norms that people should be allowed to do what they want to do, but at the same time, that's really not, we can point to other issues where people have prejudice. So I really don't know why it's have been possible regarding homosexuality. I guess what has happened in the United States has meant a lot, because they, within psychiatry, for example, the American Psychiatric Association took the disease label away 5 years or something before the Norwegian Psychiatric Association. So in many ways, Norwegian norms regarding homosexuality has followed California ways of dealing with this issue.
What is the relationship, if one could establish one, between the impact of the law as a kind of ground for equality of rights in relationship to individual psychology? And I don't mean necessarily in the case of a gay and lesbian or transgender person, but in society at large.
I have the feeling that at the department level and governmental level, the integration of new thoughts have come quite far, because they have been clever lobbyists. And they have managed to implement rights and laws regarding protection and openings for LGBT people. And that's actually more advanced than what is going on in the general public, I think. And that means that the laws makes it possible for organizations and single individuals who fight for LGBT people to have the moral support and legal support from the law texts. So I think the law comes before the change in a way,
mm-hmm.
and which makes activists it helps the activists. So there are some very slow forces going on and living their own lives, so to speak, and then the law comes and it might affect the schooling, for example, quite quick, because within 2 or 3 years changes might happen within the school system. So for example, the law in Norway changed in 72, as you said, which is 37 years ago. And then we had the diagnosis away, and then we had the legal protection for against discrimination, and so on. And today, 2 women or 2 men might marry and adopt children. So it's quite equal today.
From having researched a bit of what you do, that you have special knowledge in civil union and domestic partnerships in Norway. Could you speak a little bit to that?
I know that you spoke to a colleague of mine regarding those issues, and I did a little work with her. Our thing was that it seems to me or to us that the whole discussion regarding domestic partnerships and adoption is the whole discussion is centered around the nuclear family as a typical model. So that if you support gays and lesbians, you use your arguments from the nuclear family, because you say gays and lesbians might be as good parents as any other. And if you oppose gays and lesbians and adoption, you say you also use the nuclear family as a model, because you say gays and lesbians are not able to be as good parents as others, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then the point is that whether you're for or against, you still believe in a nuclear family. But for example, 20 years ago or more, in the gay and lesbian community in Norway, there were quite strong discussions regarding the nuclear family, and many thought that why should gays and lesbians actually model the nuclear family, since there's so many negative associations connected to that. But those kind of discussions is now totally away for the time being.
What do you think has prompted that change? Because I think this is actually an international concern, the kind of initial rejection to a heteronormative, replicating a heteronormative standard when it comes to marriage, for example. But it seems like in the 70s, but it seems like nowadays the fight is really to achieve that kind of, or to replicate that standard in many ways. Can you point to that distinction?
It might be because the activists and the organizations are very strategic. But I'm not sure if that's the only thing. I think that's part of it, and another part of it might be a general climate within Norway and other westernized countries, that the kind of movements, activist movements, have been downplayed, and you will find that within many fields regarding peace movements, women's movements, so on.
By strategic, you mean that it wants to kind of play it safe, so that it achieves a kind of legal platform?
Yeah.
But once the legal platform is achieved, what is the work that it needs to be done? Or do we need to be content with that heterosexual norm, in a sense, once the law is in place?
So, for example, that might be the issue for the Norwegian society today. But even though the legal status is very good, I think there are two, you might look at LGBT people as certain minority groups, and then you have the same issues for these groups as you have for any other minority groups, Romani people or disabled people, which is typically concerning prejudice and legal rights and things like that. But you also have this queer theory type of issues. Are we happy with the gender categories and the sexual orientation categories that we are utilizing today? So, I mean, there are many researchers and activists who really want to oppose, within a Foucauldian sense, these very disciplinary distinctions.
Which is what it's known as innate qualities of gender?
Or sorry?
Is that what is referred to as innate qualities of
yes.
gender? Can you explain that? What an innate quality would mean or means?
Yeah. It's a typical way that many scientific disciplines and many cultures views human functioning, that we think that people possess certain abilities which we are interested in. We're interested in the abilities and we look for what they are and how they are stable and so on. And we categorize people according to them very quickly. We do that all the time. And while we do that, we might overlook other interesting things about our fellow human beings. So an innate quality means a view that people are permanent in some sense, and that their mind and that their mentality or subjectivity or personhood or self is a kind of clear and consistent entity. And it's not necessarily bad to view humans like that, but it has consequences. And some people think the consequences are kind of limiting people, and others think that these distinctions are reflecting nature. So it's a huge, in a way, scientific discussion within many fields, within sociology and psychology, pedagogics, and so on.
And within within what concerns us here directly in the field of queer studies, what are the consequences of these categories?
For me, personally, when I write and do my research, I have this double view on it all the time. The categories are there, people utilize them, my colleagues utilize them, I do it myself, and at the same time I question them, and I'm interested in the consequences of having them. So I have to deal with wanting to, in a way, dissolve them and also to utilize them.
Would this be a foundational element of a kind of heteronormative logic? In the sense that if gender is categorical and these qualities are innate, hence, as a result, things should be replicated along those lines?
I'm not sure if they should be replicated, but I think they are replicated.
Right, I mean, that's the...
And I think that I contribute to that myself. So that means, within my own position as a professor here, I might do much more radical work doing gender research or sexuality research, which is really taking the step further and utilizing ways of thinking which is not reinforcing the categories. I'm not there yet.
What do you mean that you would replicate that yourself, given the kind of work that you were doing? How could it be more radical in that sense?
For example, last year I conducted a national survey regarding people's attitudes towards LGBT people. And then I'm phrasing the survey items, the questions, with fixed response alternatives, and I'm also making a report from the survey. And doing within those activities, I necessarily have to use to express myself. I have to report what I have been doing, and I have to ask people about their regarding their opinions about certain things. And when these things and my phrases are men, women, transsexuals, bisexuals, I am in a way reinforcing the categories. And that's a, it's a kind of a paradox. It's not a very bad paradox, and many people have talked about it for 30 years at least, so it's not a new thing, but it's there constantly.
So the radicality for you lies in kind of redefining language, I mean the language categories in a way?
Yes, I guess the radical, this is a very stimulating interview because you're asking me, you're challenging me in a way, but not to create a new language, but it would be maybe to try to have access to people's experiences in a more open way, where I'm aim at getting behind or below the categories. So it would mean another research methodology.
How would you convey this at a society, a societal level? I mean, if, because that's just simply the way we learn things, mm-hmm. right? There's man, there's women, there is these categories as they are defined. What would be the challenge to change that logic within society?
I don't know of any official strategic efforts at changing it, right? And I don't have a prescription myself, because as soon as we have a prescription, very soon the prescription will itself be a kind of limiting process very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I also have the feeling that the societal changes that we are going through in Norway and countries like ours, maybe we don't overlook what's going on. I mean, it's difficult to analyze what's going on within yourself and within our own society right now. There might be some structural changes or language changes that we really don't capture in a way.
If we may shift maybe a little bit, I would like to speak about the notion of sexual citizenship and how that has been accomplished here in this kind of legislative environment, and how that translates again in a kind of societal level.
For many citizens in Norway, the issue of their sexuality, it's not a big issue in a way when it comes to formal status regarding voting and economic rights and things like that. I think for most LGBT people, that is not the main issue in their lives in a way regarding citizenship. But in some cities, like in Bergen, for example, and Oslo, the two largest cities in Norway, on an official level there, they have decided to have what they called an implementation plan regarding LGBT issues, where they want to implement legal status, and that LGBT issues should be not invisible on the workplaces, for example, on a nursing home, not the patients, not the employees. So in a way, the issue of LGBT as a theme is now highlighted more than only 5 years before. And that might lead to a process where the issue of sexuality or identity might have a stronger status, so to speak, regarding citizenship, regarding the the student, the pupil, or the patient, or the employee, or teacher, it might be easier to speak up and say, I'm a tea person and I want to fight for it, and all other knows that, yes, you're entitled to do that.
If you can, again, speak about the adoption debate, mm-hmm. again, and what is your take on that?
We have our cultural notions of what is good for a child, which is partly based on maybe prejudice and partly based on psychological research and pedagogical research, things like that. And I mean, what do we want children to have when they grow? It's, well, we don't want them to freeze, we want them to have enough food. And then what kind of psychological things do we want for them? And we want them to have probably stable relationships. We want them to be alert and to be positive towards life, things like that. And I'm not sure what these things are that we want to accomplish for children. But for me, the issue of gender and sexuality is in a way disconnected to that. So I mean sexual orientation, as we know it today, and gender, as we know it today, does not have any logic connection to what we generally want small children to have as they grow up. So what I'm saying is that gays and lesbians should be allowed to raise children, right? So I think all of this discussion should be connected to what we want children to accomplish. It should not be connected to parental gender or sexuality. But I mean, that's a typical argument for any all the gay and lesbian organizations. So I mean, I'm just paraphrasing them.
Right. And what, which is the case here, right? Mm. In Norway, people, gay and lesbian families can adopt and raise children. What was that process like? What was it in terms of its reception in society, its representation in the media, and so on and so forth? What was that kind of battle like?
You know, gays and lesbians parents, or who want to be parents, what they say, and all their supporters say, that two women who raise a daughter, they will obviously expose the daughter to male role models, for example, because they are nice parents and they will do that with their brothers and uncles and things like that. But you might also say, why should they? I mean, to have male models, is that so important? Maybe it is. I'm not sure about that. So, I find it interesting that, again, so few activists has argued that our wish to model the nuclear family is a wrong path to go. We should develop our own ways of establishing communities or families. But that, of course, I can understand people who strategically do not argue that way.
From the perception of the majority on these issues, what is that in relationship to, for example, issues of oppression and discrimination?
I think a general viewpoint in Norway is that now we have the legal status. Why do some people talk so much about sexual categories? We don't care. In a way, I don't think that's not a valid argument, because all these people who are affected by this, so to speak, that means LGBT people themselves, they care, and it's an important thing for them individually. And since this is very important to them, it must mean something to all the others. I mean, LGBT people do not go around and misinterpret the world constantly. It's something there which makes some issues difficult, obviously. While the majority tends to think, why is this a big issue anymore? So I'm really not good at pointing to the correct concepts or ways of analyzing that. But on the one level, it's not important thing. On another level, it's important.
You said that maybe attitudes reflected the law were following the law earlier.
Mm.
But now, from what you're saying, it seems that that there is a kind of slip between the general perception of the implementation of this law and the actual reality of that behavior as perceived by the LGBT community. Can you point to that? It almost feels like a paradox in a sense.
But I think that in face-to-face situations, which is a situation that people know because that's how we live our lives, in those kind of situations, the issue of identity, sexual identity, is of concern. Often it is of concern. While the way we measure attitudes and the way the law is developed and written, it's not concerning face-to-face interactions. It's concerning huge types of activities in our lives. And that means these huge concepts and huge activities, everything might be equal and legal correctly, in a politically correct, while in face-to-face interaction, it's another sphere of experience which is not explicitly stated by the law or by the surveys. So I think that that's why people in their daily experiences see other things than what the law makes explicit. But I still think that the law makes possible that activists, organizations, researchers like me and colleagues, we have the legal right to do our things and to sort of support and to make possible that general public change bit by bit. I will make a report on the Norwegian population's attitudes towards transsexuals. And transsexuals means here those persons who really want to go through an operation, physical operation. And it also includes people who are gender benders, or they do not so typical things regarding gender. So, and it seems like the Norwegian population have, again, quite open-minded attitudes, but these issues have not been so much publicly, it's not been so debated publicly. So people are not so sensitized to that issue as they are to the adoption question, for example. It's because the people with the T people have not been lifted up as some important groups or important type of experiences that the public has been discussing much. It's been a medical concern for many, many, many years, and it's only the last 10 or 20 years that these groups have come up as an issue.
Are there any overarching characterizations of that, or of the way that this group is perceived in the general public?
I think the media definitely plays a role. But you know, you have these huge tensions that within some T people believe that gender is a certain thing and they belong to a certain category there, while other T people really oppose the gender distinctions, so that it's a huge, huge variation. And it's only recently that these discussions or tensions have become public in and to me it's it's a good thing that this is public, because it shows that the variety is greater than we normally think.
And what is the emphasis of this report that you're working on, if you may explain that?
The emphasis would be that people are generally positive here as well, as regarding their attitudes to gays and lesbians. So I want to discuss in the report the, not tension, but the fact that when people are asked simple overall questions, they tend to report positive attitudes.
What is the methodology of your work, of your research? And when you speak about people, who are the people that you are talking about?
This is a standardized type of poll, so it's people from all over Norway, all ages, various educational backgrounds and so on. It's a representative sample.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are asked questions. What is your general attitude towards a bisexual woman? And then you have to grade it from to tick off one of five categories, for example. So within this frame, it's totally fixed.
Do you play a role in the phrasing of these questions, in the posing of these questions?
Yes.
How do you phrase a question like that?
We have this notion of that people go around with certain characteristics, being lesbian or gay or bisexual or so on. And we have this notion of attitudes, that people have attitudes on something. So we, Ella or I, as a researcher, or within my research community, it's a notion that there is some mental thing in humans that we might call attitude. And if we have a notion of attitude, a notion of sexual categories, one might argue that it's interesting to ask, well, what are these stable mental things regarding valuing positive or negative, regarding some objects, which here is, for example, bisexual people.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said earlier, phrasing a question like that is really not going beyond the categorization issue at all. It's reinforcing it.
Correct.
So, I'm aware that when I'm phrasing the questions and when I'm doing my report from all of this, I'm reinforcing the categories. But at the same time, I might be able to write in a way or to problematize it so that what we're talking about now is highlighted as well.
So you could, would there be a way of radicalizing the method?
Yes.
By a different...
Oh, yes.
Form of posing the question, and if so, what holds you back to do that? Is that an institutional concern, or is that a...
Yes, it's... you might use other methodologies, like observing conversations within psychology. It might be things like that. When I'm using survey methods myself, it's because that's what I'm trained to do, and that's what my field is good at. So I thought, I should maybe not utilize methodologies like that, because it's not really getting behind the phenomena. But at the same time, good survey research might be good also. So I'm, at least for the time being, I believe that it's possible to do this kind of research while at the same time being aware that there are other methodologies which might shed another light on the same type of things. The research groups where I'm sitting are open-minded, but their expertise is quite traditional within psychology, which is utilizing quantitative measures and so on.
Is that a conflict for you? Is that something that that you struggle with? I mean, maybe this is too much of a personal question, but is that Do you struggle with methodologies and with the institutionalized procedures?
Yes, in a way, but it's not. Now, when I have my position here, nobody challenges that, so it's actually, I'm in a position where I can really choose. So what holds me back is more that my expertise has been within survey methods. So it's not easy to put your methodology training aside.
But it is healthy to question it, I suppose.
Yes.
Can you speak about what the greatest challenge is at the moment for the LGBT community in this country?
As a researcher, I'm interested in shedding light on the social processes that are reinforcing the categories we're talking about. And that will be an interest which is, it will be there within my life, always, I think. And that's an interest which is applicable to other types of categories that we deal with, alcoholics or non-alcoholics, for example, and so on. So the challenge within the field is, what shall I say, a theoretical challenge, how to deal with categories and the dissolving of them and the reinforcing of them. But when it comes to the LGBT groups in Norway, maybe one important concern would be to expose harassment and expose different difficult matters for them. As long as the legal status is very good, it's important to show that there is much inequality in face-to-face interactions. Many LGBT people hesitate to tell other people that that's their identity. And why should they hesitate? There must be some kind of face-to-face interactions making it difficult. And what are those? And it's important to expose that, I think.
That actually has been my experience here in the few weeks that I've been going about. I've met several gay men and also lesbian women that are not out.
Right.
So why are people concealing their sexual identity?
I think it might be a mixture of three things. It might be a real fear of harassment or rejection. Not important rejection, but at least face-to-face kind of rejection. So one hesitate for those kind of reasons. You don't risk being put to jail, but you risk that people move themselves a little bit more from you, things like that. And then it might be an issue of being shy. And then it might be an issue of a kind of a queer sensitivity within LGBT people, that as in the moment you expose that you have an identity in those kind of directions, you are trapped, so to speak. That means all of your friends and families will view you like this, you yourself will do it, and you might have a hesitation which is concerning the issue of being categorized, not because it's bad, but being categorized as such. So in Norway, it might be something to investigate. Is it because the Norwegian population don't want to be, because they're shy, don't want to be categorized, in a combination of the fear of rejection?
There is a slight contradiction between this open or positive attitude of the general public in relationship to these issues, as the polls show it, with what clearly shows that it must be elsewhere, otherwise, in the sense that if I am fearful to tell my mother or my friends or to be categorized in that sense, then the perception is that it is not open and it is not welcoming.
That's my experience too. I mean, that's how I view this landscape too. Because the polls, people report positive attitudes, and they're not lying or pretending or anything. They do want to express positive attitudes. But those attitudes are concerning abstract situations and abstract people. So when concrete LGBT people deals with their all other people, they have to, that's another type of situations. So that's what I wanted to thematize when we talked earlier, that maybe you need another methodology to capture these issues.
Well, it seems because it's hard to think of what the effect of this methodology is on the actual life of people.
Yep. Right?
Because ultimately, I suppose what I'm most interested in is that people have good, healthy lives.
Mm.
And it seems like the platform is there legislatively in this country, but from what I have heard around, there is still a little bit of a gray area.
Yeah, I agree.